Did I put the clothes in the dryer?
I hope they don't think I was
sleeping. I need to be awake.
Snacks.
I forgot
my brain shut
off.
Just sleep already.
When your racing thoughts keep you up at night, it's tough to let go and get the rest you need. Better sleep can help. You might have heard of white or brown noise. There's a whole rainbow of color noises, and they can help you calm your mind, reduce stress, and sleep better, like the green noise you're listening to now. With the Better Sleep app, you can discover more color noises and over 200 soothing sounds, guided meditations, and bedtime stories. High-quality rest is vital to your mental well-being and physical health. Calm your restless mind, conquer your day, and sleep better at night. Download Better Sleep from the App Store or Google Play and start a 7-day trial today. Because when you sleep better, you feel better.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell. And if you know my husband, Dax, then you also know he loves shopping for a car. Selling a car? Not so much.
We're really doing this, huh?
Thankfully, Carvana makes it easy. Answer a few questions, put in your VIN or license, and done. We sold ours in minutes this morning, and they'll come pick it up and pay us this afternoon.
Goodbye, Truckee.
Of course, we kept the favorite.
Hello, other Truckee.
Sell your car with Carvana today. Terms and conditions apply.
And welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, a weekly podcast hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Full of Beans is here to share the unheard voices of those who are living with, supporting, researching, or working in the field of eating disorders. Each conversation aims to bring a different perspective and understanding so that together we can learn, advocate, and connect to realise we are not alone in our struggles and that recovery is possible. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode. And just a gentle reminder that these episodes are not a replacement for therapeutic support. So if you are struggling, please do reach out and know that there will always be someone there to listen. And finally, thank you to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital, for your continued support. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Rachel Egan. Rachel is a mental health campaigner who has personal experience of anorexia, binge eating, laxative use, depression, and anxiety. Rachel is the strategic communications and marketing manager for Jump the Scales, a trainer and activist who delivers eating disorder training sessions and has appeared on Sky News, BBC News, and has her own column on the Huffington Post, all with the aim of improving the understanding of eating disorders. This week, Rachel joins me to discuss her experience of anorexia, binge eating, and laxative use. And we also talk about the impact of GLP-1s, how she would have felt with GLP-1s becoming increasingly popular when she was abusing laxatives, and also her worries and concerns for the general population as GLP-1s become more available. Thank you so much for listening, and I really hope you enjoy this episode. Hello, Rachel. It's so nice to have you on the podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thank you, Hannah. Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to speak to you today.
It feels like this conversation, I think it's probably my fault, we've been trying to have for so long, but I actually am glad that we've postponed it because today we're going to be talking about something that's very topical and also something I think that you are extremely passionate about. So I'm really, really excited to have you on today.
Thank you.
So did you want to introduce yourself for the listeners?
Absolutely. So my name is Rachel Egan. I am an eating disorder campaigner. So I'm part of the Dump the Scales team with Hope Virgo. I've also worked at National Mind. And I am a communications and marketing manager in the charity sector.
Nice. Very cool. Very fancy little introduction there. So it's lovely to have you. And, you know, it's been so nice working with you, you know, and all the work that we've done. So I'm very glad to have you on the podcast. I wondered if you wanted to start, and I hate doing this because I feel like I'm saying to people, like, tell me your life story in 30 seconds. But did you want to share a bit about your own eating disorder experience and where your passion for campaigning came from?
Yeah, of course. So I developed anorexia when I was around 14, 15. And so for context, I'm 34 now, so it's been a long time since then. I became very physically unwell very quickly. You know, back then there was even less recognition and understanding of eating disorders than there is now. My parents really didn't know how to handle it. The treatment that I got potentially wasn't the most helpful. I had psychodynamic psychotherapy, and I was kind of told one of the reasons for my eating disorder was that I wanted to drown my little sister, which was an incredibly odd interpretation of anorexia, even by those standards back in the day. You know, there wasn't a lot of talk around addressing some of the faulty thinking patterns in eating disorders, talking through some of the body image concerns I had, and also how to develop a bit of a healthier relationship with food. It was all very much based on dream analysis, subconscious, those kinds of things. I'm sure you know how it is, Hannah, sort of dotted in and out of recovery, like not quite fully well, but not really like super unwell. And throughout my later adolescence, and then when I went to university, I did become quite unwell again in my first year at university. I think, unfortunately, living next to a gym in student halls was probably not the most helpful outcome for me. And I started to have fainting episodes, and I became quite unwell again. I did manage to go back for my second year, but that is when I started having problems with binge eating and taking laxatives. And I know that's a common part of some people's recovery journey, but I think it's really important that we address, like, not just the restrictive part of eating disorders, but also the binge eating and the shame and stuff that comes with that. I did manage to overcome that. I did have some support, and I kind of graduated in a really good place, I would say. Like, you know, felt really good. I was in a good place in recovery. I started my career in marketing. I had quite a toxic work experience, work environment when I was about 22, very kind of on the very severe end, sort of the police were involved, the company went under, all kinds of things. And that kind of led to a relapse in my anorexia. So I then became sort of introduced to adult services only after about 4 years of struggling, which was kind of how long it took for anyone to really realize what was going on. Even though my weight was quite low, I didn't really want to accept it. My GP was basically like, well, I'm not going to bother referring you because it's a 3-year waiting list. And, you know, you seem to be managing okay. Like, I was quite high functioning, if that makes sense, with anorexia. I did then get into adult eating disorder services, outpatient treatment. I found it helpful, definitely. But I think I was living alone at the time and not having anyone sort of support me at home with like changing my eating habits and like supporting me at mealtimes made it a little bit difficult. So I had some private treatment. And I would say I've been in recovery for about 2 years now. And I am now happily married and living with my husband in our first flat together.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. And it's so lovely to hear that things are better now and that you're married, and that's still an end to that. So it's not the end of your story, but a nice new chapter, I suppose.
Yes.
And I mean, I can really relate to what you were saying about the transition into adult services. I didn't live alone when I was in adult services, but it very much felt like it was like, okay, this is down to you now, like irrespective of what you're struggling with or what have you, this is on you now. And we can be here, but we're not really going to have that much input, which I guess when you're then living on your own makes it so much more difficult if you've not got somebody saying, have you eaten today? Or, you know, preparing your meals. And one thing I wanted to ask you about, because I think it's something that, as you said, like it's not spoken about enough, was your experience of binge eating and laxative use when you were in recovery from anorexia. Because I've heard, like, anecdotally, a lot of people say that they have transitioned from anorexic tendencies to then binge eating. But I think, as you've said, there's a lot of shame attached to it. So people don't necessarily share what they've been through.
Yeah, definitely. For me, it was probably mentally maybe my lowest point, whereas I would say physically my lowest point was maybe in the height of my anorexia, if that makes sense. And I think a huge part of that is the shame that is attached to binge eating. So, you know, eating my housemate's food, for example, and then having to replace it before they found out, and spending a lot of time alone in my room, like binge eating, it felt very, very shameful. And I also think the way that society kind of sees binge eating or sees weight gain or things like that leads to this kind of sense that you should have to hide yourself and you shouldn't be able to talk about it, if that makes sense.
I think you're right. I think that there's a big thing in society in terms of if you are losing weight, your behaviors are glorified. If you are gaining weight, it's like, what the hell? What are you doing? And that, I think, can make it so difficult. I think it's difficult, you know, in society with binge eating, but particularly when you've transitioned from something that's so glorified to then try and speak up about something that's so stigmatized, I can imagine is really, really difficult.
Yeah, it's probably, you know, I do some training in schools and kind of share my story a little bit, but I don't tend to really even focus so much on the binge eating side of things, because it was quite shameful. And also being aware that for me, abusing laxatives was part of that and was sort of a form of purging, I guess, for me, although my diagnosis was sort of technically anorexia, I would say it was kind of a form of purging. And not wanting to encourage people, you know, laxative abuse is incredibly dangerous. And I had to stop because of the harm I was doing to my body and, you know, became very, very sick with it, those kinds of things. But that also carries a layer of shame around it. And I was really, I know it's a bit more of a recent change, probably only in the past 4 years, but I was really pleased to see that if you go into Superdrug, for example, and you go to buy laxatives, there is now Challenge 25 on it, which says if you are under the age of 25, we will ask you to provide ID before you provide laxatives, and they will only supply, I think it's 2 packets or like something like that. I feel like changes like that could have really helped me back then. So it's really positive that the eating disorder community of campaigners, and I know a lot of people worked on that campaign to bring in that legislation, has had that change.
Yeah, I mean, that is fantastic. I suppose it's still difficult for the people that are over 25,
but yes, of course,
but seeing things like that happen, and I guess just that general awareness of the issues that it can kind of co-occur with, it is a really great kind of shift in the right direction. I hope it's okay for me to ask, like, I guess the first time that you used laxatives, what was your thought behind using them? Or how did that thought come about to you?
That's a really good question. I think it was definitely from a place of disgust with myself and from a need to, sorry, I'm very conscious of not wanting to trigger anybody here, but from a need to feel kind of clean and pure again after a binge. Also, I suppose for me, part of the motivation for taking laxatives wasn't just about getting rid of calories, but it was also about causing myself pain, to punish myself for the fact that I'd had these binge eating behaviours. I suppose an eating disorder really warps your mind, and it makes you think that, you know, you deserve to be in pain and like you deserve this. Obviously now I'm in a much better place and I realise that's not true. And even if you do binge eat, you don't need to punish yourself. It doesn't help. But at the time, that's where my head was at.
I ask because I'm saying this in a very compassionate way, and also with the understanding of how much an eating disorder kind of manipulates your brain. Because from a nutritionist's perspective, or like a scientific perspective, we know that laxatives, you know, they don't promote weight loss because the food has already been absorbed in your body. But I can completely relate to, and that's not something I've actually even considered before with laxative misuse, in terms of that feeling of being clean inside or just kind of wanting the food out of you. So I really appreciate you sharing that. And when you say you experienced pain, what sort of symptoms did you have from the laxative misuse?
So very severe abdominal cramps, kind of to the point where I struggled to walk with them. It could be so painful, and also without wanting to be too gross, but kind of blood in the toilet when I go to the bathroom, like that sort of thing. And it made me feel at times quite faint and dehydrated, which I think I now realise is quite a common symptom, because obviously they do to a certain extent dehydrate you. I just didn't necessarily put 2 and 2 together at the time.
This is me making an assumption, but I find it amazing how an eating disorder can manipulate your brain so much that you don't put things like that together. I mean, in my experience, I've not misused laxatives, but my kind of, I guess, purging behavior would be excessive exercise. My brain could never put together that the reason that I was ill all the time or so fatigued or tired all the time was because I was doing 2 HIIT workouts a day. Like, if you'd have said to me, hey, why do you think you're tired? I'd be like, I don't know, like, body's just weak. But it's crazy how much it can manipulate your brain.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's something that's probably really hard for carers to get their head around. Like, I feel like, you know, if you have a child with an eating disorder or a partner with an eating disorder, and you can see what it's doing to their body and the damage it's doing to the body and their mental health as well, like obviously both, I find it really difficult to explain to people that when you're in it, you can't see it yourself. I saw like a really good, I think it's like a, no, memes, probably not the right word, a post on the internet where it said that having an eating disorder is like seeing a picture of a chair, and you can see that that chair is painted red, like the legs are red, the seat bit is red, and the armrests are red, etc. But your recovery is based on you believing everybody else around you who is saying that that chair is green. And that is where you have to kind of see it from the point of view as a carer, is we see that chair as red, even though you are insisting that it's bright green. And that to me is kind of how, like you said, you don't always see the impact that eating disorder is having on you in the midst of it.
I think that's a really, really good analogy in terms of how much your brain can be distorted but not realise that, and actually believe that your truth in your head is solid truth. Like, how can it not be?
Yeah.
And I think I also found that very difficult then in recovery, as you're saying there with the chair example, because you have to basically put your faith and trust in everybody around you, and you almost have to not believe your own intuition. But through the process of recovery, you have to learn to then trust yourself again. So it's so tricky. And you know, part of that is because a lot of your thoughts when you're in the depth of an eating disorder are consumed by an eating disorder. And then it's about, you know, working through and working out what's your thought compared to the eating disorder thought. But when you've had an eating disorder and all your thoughts are consumed by the eating disorder, it's so difficult to go through recovery and piece apart, you know, your truth, the eating disorder's truth, everyone around you's truths. And that, I think, is one of the hardest things I found about recovery, because the fear mongering as well from the eating disorder. I don't know whether you had this, like, you know, if you stop taking laxatives, then XYZ is going to happen. I never personally got to the XYZ is going to happen. It was just, you can't stop doing that behavior. And then putting your faith in the people around you who are saying you actually need to stop that is terrifying.
Yeah, definitely. It really does feel like a complete leap of faith, almost into the abyss. I feel like it's a bit like being asked to jump off a cliff 3 times a day and, like, you know, committing to every meal is just blindly jump off this cliff, even though you are terrified about what's going to happen. You don't know what the fall is going to look like. I need you to do it. And I think it's really important that carers understand that, but also that they're supported to understand that and to facilitate their loved one's recovery around some of those fears.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's one thing explaining it and hoping that carers can understand, but equally being able to understand that is very difficult. And I know for me, you know, what you were saying before about, like, your loved ones around you can see the detriment that you're doing to yourselves, but you can't stop. Like, they need support with that as well, to know that you're not actually doing it to be malicious to them, or, you know, you don't want to hurt them. That's actually the worst thing in the world. You really don't want to do that, but it feels like the only way to survive in that moment. Just going back to your misuse of laxatives, at what point did you think, or what was it that you were like, oh, actually probably need to do something about this, if you didn't maybe think that it was an issue?
I passed out basically in the bathroom and was like, I hit my head off the floor, and obviously it was a tiled floor because it's bathroom. I was fine. I just want to be clear, like, I was okay, just a bit of an embarrassing bruise. But I think that was a real wake-up call to be like, this cannot go on. I was also alone in the house. All my flatmates had gone out when it happened. So I just think, had it been worse, like I said, I was probably only out for like 5 seconds or like whatever, but had it been worse, like, it could have been really serious, if that makes sense. And I could have, like, really hurt myself. I think it kind of shocked me a little bit, to be honest. And also, without wanting to be too gross, it's very unpleasant to deal with laxative misuse when you are trying to go about your day. You know, it's very unpleasant, kind of walking from place to place and having to know where the bathrooms are. I suppose just to a certain extent, I just felt like it was ruining my life, to be honest. It did take a while to obviously reach that point. I feel like, yeah, I maybe had to hit rock bottom a little bit. And I hope for anyone listening to this who is taking laxatives that, you know, you doesn't need to go that far. Like, you absolutely can stop as soon as you feel ready to, or at least reduce.
Yeah. I mean, when you said about, you know, fainting and hitting your head on the floor and it could have been much worse, that sounds pretty, you know, a pretty awful situation to go through. So, you know, I'm very glad to hear that you've been able to kind of stop using the laxatives and find recovery from that. In a weird tangent, but also it feels quite relevant, I know today we wanted to also speak about GLP-1 medications. And I know that you've shared a bit on social media about how, particularly with your history of laxative misuse, you know, you're concerned about the rise of GLP-1s. I wondered if you wanted to maybe talk a little bit about where that concern comes from.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have a huge amount of concerns. about weight loss jabs, to be honest. But if we focus a little bit on maybe the eating disorder angle to start, and then I'm very happy to open it up to everything else I have concerns about them. Obviously, for me, my eating disorder made me feel compelled in many ways to abuse laxatives and slimming pills in an attempt to keep my weight under control. I definitely would have bought or had somehow found access to weight loss jabs if they had been available on the high street like they now are in my late teens or early 20s, you know. And I think we need to consider the impact on people with eating disorders, restrictive eating disorders, as well as people with binge eating disorder, on how that's going to have an impact on their physical and mental health. And what I mean by that is that weight loss jabs are known to work by kind of reducing our hunger hormones so that our body doesn't recognize the impact. Part of my recovery journey was very much learning to tune into like my early hunger signals to avoid like sort of letting things get too far where I'm really, really hungry. But for someone with binge eating disorder, learning to respect your natural hunger cues, sorry, and your fullness cues is also an important part of their recovery. We also know from a lot of research on these weight loss jabs that nearly everyone who comes off them regains the weight they lost within 10 months to 2 years. And I have concerns about the impact of weight loss and weight regain, in what is a very diet culture, image obsessed society. You know, and we're seeing the return of early noughties diet culture on social media, across Skinny Talk, across TikTok already. So I just have massive concerns about how it's going to impact people with eating disorders who need support to tackle their issues around food and eating, but also the general public who may not be aware of the serious side effects. So I think what a lot of people don't realize is that there have already been 10 deaths here in the UK linked to weight loss jabs, where they are looking into things like multiple organ failure, pancreatitis, gallbladder disease. And I just don't think that the rhetoric we have around weight loss jabs and the ease of access we have is proportionate to those dangers, if that makes sense.
Totally. I didn't realise that the amount of deaths was one, let alone 10. I think the biggest thing that concerns me, and please correct me if I've got the wrong message here, but these drugs were originally tested for people that had diabetes, and the dosages that were tested in clinical trials as safe are not the same doses that people are being given, or in fact that people are gaining access to. Because of the lack of regulations that we have around these drugs, people are taking way, way more than what they should be doing, which is then what's leading to all of these deaths. And I think that there's absolutely a place for these drugs to be present for people with conditions like diabetes, for people that have a BMI of over 40 that can't walk and aren't able to change their diet in order to lose weight so that they can lead healthy, fulfilling lives. I think that there is absolutely a place. My concern comes about people who are at a healthy weight, who are using them in order to be thin and be thin at any cost. I think we live in a society where it is skinny above all. And that terrifies me because people are willing to put themselves into extremely vulnerable positions to get extremely ill, potentially, to potentially die at the cost of being skinny. And that's, I think, the thing that worries me the most, is that that is the absolute pinnacle, and almost people will do anything in order to get there. Like, as you were saying, when in the noughties we had, you know, the heroin chic and things like that, and I was so happy that we were shifting away from that body ideal, because it was just so unhealthy and so detrimental for people's mental health. And I find it, I'm honestly terrified. I have no other words, that I'm just terrified of what's going on.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think I agree with the thinness at all costs and pursue thinness at all costs. But I also found that the way the health secretary talked about making Britain fat free by 2035 in his press release was really unhelpful and really disrespectful to people living in larger bodies. A fat body or a larger body is not a body that has to be fixed. Like, you deserve to live and be treated well in whatever bloody body size you come in. Like, that's just it. That's the bottom line. Everyone deserves to be treated well. I personally feel like body size is one of the last remaining characteristics that should be a protected characteristic, like your race, like your ethnicity, like your age, like your disability status. we know that people in larger bodies are discriminated against when it comes to jobs, when it comes to healthcare. And to me, how in this day and age, when we've got so much more understanding of diversity and how important diversity is, are we still allowing people in larger bodies to be treated and discriminated against like this? We know for a fact that 40 to 70% of your weight is determined by your genes. It's not necessarily a personal choice. There's a huge amount of social determinants around obesity, living in poverty, living in food deserts, not having access to green spaces. These are all the things that if we actually want to build a healthier society, that's what we need to be addressing. I just want to pick up on your point. I think you talked a bit about private prescriptions for weight loss jabs. And this is where I really feel like the problem kind of lies, if that makes sense, is you talked about the clinical trials in people with diabetes. And obviously people who are taking it for diabetes are having clinical monitoring. So for example, they might have a diabetes nurse, they'll probably have their GP, you know, various other health professionals who are dealing with it. There are people going into supermarkets now, like Morrison's, getting their hands on these weight loss jabs. For some of them, we've heard reports from pharmacists that people are stuffing weights in their backpack and then they're getting on the scale so that they look heavier, so that they qualify for weight loss jabs. They're fudging photographs of themselves so that they can qualify for them. It's these private prescriptions and these people who are then going home with no monitoring, no clinical input. And these are probably the people who are more likely to suffer from those side effects. And like you said, like, I do not blame these people for taking these drugs whatsoever. And I saw, you know, a very difficult story about a mother who put her 11-year-old daughter on them. And whilst I felt, you know, quite shocked and horrified at first, when I broke it down, I thought, well, this is what fat phobia and this is what size discrimination is doing to our society. It's like you said, we are pursuing thin at any cost. And that is ultimately where my biggest problem lies with these drugs, is the lack of regulation, the explosion onto the market that could have been prevented. We know there are lots of people who have written to, you know, various services, various pharmaceutical companies saying this is going to be a problem and we've just let it happen. That's maybe where I feel the most strongly, as you can probably tell, Hannah. I'll calm down.
You know, the story that you just shared about a mum putting their 11-year-old on, as you said, you know, initially when you hear that, you're shocked. But I can understand from a mother's perspective of being so worried about your child being bullied, not fitting in, because you've heard in the news or what have you of all of the health implications of being overweight, not that they're actually factual. I think that we are terrified as a society of being overweight. And as you've said, there's so many determinants of weight. And I think it's another kind of sign that we are obsessed with losing weight, because, you know, all of the research that's come out over the past few years about, you know, health at every size and the fact that, you know, your weight isn't the only determinant of health and things like that. As soon as there's access to weight loss drugs, you know, people care more about that than anything other. And the ease of access is absolutely terrifying. As you said, you know, the legislation needs to be there. But I also think, just going back to another point that you made in terms of people regaining the weight, what happens when they come off the injections, I'm not saying that I'm not against weight loss if people are doing it in a healthy way and they are monitored. And I don't even know how to say it, because I feel like in this context, it is just triggering. But I think there are instances where it can be okay. However,
right support. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, I know people in my life that they are at a body weight that means that they can't exercise, they can't physically get about, and they have accessed GLP-1 medications to enable them to lose some weight, which now means that they can walk, it means that they can cycle, it means that they can lead a healthy lifestyle. It's not that they've now, you know, lost so much weight that they've now developed an eating disorder. I'm not wanting that for anybody, but I can appreciate there's situations where it's suitable. But with that has to come behavioural intervention, because those people can't be on the medications for the rest of their life. You have to teach people about sleep, about nutrition, about hydration, about stress management and all of those different things. If you don't have that educational piece, it's not going to support somebody. So I think that's where my biggest frustration comes, particularly with the like 10-year plan that's just come out. It's very much just relying on weight loss medication to support people to lose weight. But where's the other bit of support that actually helps them to develop a healthy relationship with food and exercise?
I totally agree. I think it's a really short-term solution. And to be honest, I hate to say it, but I think it's going to massively backfire. I agree that a huge part of the problem around this is lack of regulation. There is a lack of regulatory guidance on who accesses these drugs, how they access them, and who monitors them afterwards. So that's definitely one point. And then the second point is the lack of behavioural intervention and the lack of not even behavioural intervention necessarily at the doctor's surgery, but are there more community groups of people to join who are maybe going on a similar weight loss journey? Obviously, it wouldn't be suitable for somebody like us with an eating disorder, but for people who don't have eating disorders and are looking at making healthy lifestyle changes, where is the social support? Where is the support from professionals, whether that is, you know, GP, nurses, whoever it might be? And, you know, that ongoing journey, that's the bit that isn't in the NHS 10-year plan. And wasn't made clear. And it's not just something you can just do on an app. Like, we're not, you know, we're not robots. We're not just set to kind of calculate calories on a calculator and then everything goes away and our problems all disappear. No, people need social support. They need someone to have a conversation with. They need long-term, smaller lifestyle changes. But yes, I do want to say that I do agree with you. I do think these jabs will have a positive impact on some members of the population. And I, you know, I welcome people making positive lifestyle changes. Like you said, if they, that then gives them the freedom to run after their kids or like go on a cycle ride, like whatever, you know, I think that is fantastic. But it does need to be with the right support and regulated correctly.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that without that support, you know, if we think about the lifestyle that somebody may lead if they are morbidly obese and they can't leave the house, they are probably going to be quite lonely. That is, you know, socializing is something that they may struggle with. So actually the role of community won't just be to support each other in a Weight Watchers fashion to be like, woohoo, you lost 10 pounds this week. It will be to find friendship, to find community, to find other people, which has such a positive impact on our mental health. Get us outside, get us, you know, meeting new people. And I think that that's seeing the wider picture of a healthy lifestyle rather than just solely this focus on weight. And I think another thing, which you kind of pointed to earlier, I think with the weight loss injections and the way that they're being marketed at the moment, it is very much just saying food is the issue and your ability to not stop eating is the issue. And so these weight loss injections, they prevent cravings, you know, the food noise stops. And that's what people are saying in terms of binge eating disorder is, well, they're fantastic. Use them to treat binge eating disorder because people won't feel the urge to binge anymore because that food noise stops. But that is so dismissive of us, as you said, we're not robots, we are humans. And if people are using food as a way to cope, because that's often what it is, you know, particularly with binge eating disorder, it is people aren't doing it because they have no self-control. They're doing it because food is being used as a vehicle to communicate, I'm really not okay right now, and this is my coping mechanism. And so by just saying simply to somebody, well, just take this drug because it will stop that food noise. Okay, that might be great. And I know that people are arguing, well, that could be good in order to stop that food noise, to regulate people's eating and then provide the psychological input. But what happens when they come off the drugs and the food noise returns?
This is my concern. What happens when they come off the drugs? They cannot be on them for life. Most people probably can't afford to be on them for life. My understanding is they're pretty expensive. And like you said, even if they do lose weight and they get psychological support, I can see how maybe for a short period of time, it might help them sort of make the changes and get the support that they need. But long term, what does that picture look like when they come off? And if they come off these drugs and they regain weight, where is the psychological support for that? And also, ultimately, these weight loss drugs don't address the fact that we have a huge problem with fat phobia in society. And actually, we'd probably be, all of us would be healthier, you know, whatever end of the scale you're on, if we didn't have such a huge focus on avoiding fat and instead we put the focus on feeling strong or feeling healthy or having lots of energy or, you know, those kinds of things.
Yeah. And on the subject of feeling strong, that's what concerns me as well, is the amount of muscle loss people are experiencing on the weight loss injections. And I was speaking to somebody the other day and we were talking about, you know, what's your biggest concern about weight loss medication? And they said, you know, once we get to a point where everyone can access weight loss medication and everyone can be skinny, we'll just see another shift in a body ideal. Because as soon as everybody can access it, it becomes something that we don't want. So, you know, when we're in famine in the 50s, it was well, you know, being curvy is good.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden we can afford, we're in a society where we can afford food, skinny's back in. So yeah. When we're all skinny, I personally feel that it will be, everyone will be on steroids to get muscular.
Probably.
And so it's a constant thing of the newest kind of trend, and the people that can afford it will be able to achieve it. They'll feel better about themselves. The people that can't afford it, their mental health issues just simply get worse. And it's just that constant cycle. And, you know, you can literally look at the timeline of body image ideals over the past, and it's changed so dramatically. So it does concern me, you know, not only how this is going to pan out, but what's going to be next.
Yeah, I think you're right. I feel like every time the majority of the population can attain a certain body standard, they just move the goalposts. So, and I think, you know, part of this is obviously evil marketing world want to sell more products, want to make women and men feel bad about themselves so that they continue to buy products. But yes, you're absolutely right. You know, it probably will move maybe to steroids because there'll be muscle wastage, from weight loss injections. And we're already seeing it. You know, I go into schools and I deliver kind of body image training sessions. And they used to say to me, you know, we're really worried about the girls. The girls, you know, really want to be very thin. They want to be very skinny. And now we're really worried about the boys. Like, they're going into the gym in their school gyms and, you know, taking steroids. They're buying them off the guy down the gym that they don't know. And a lot of these young men, like, they're only, you know, 13, 14. They haven't really completed puberty. And they're taking steroids, working out, you know, for an extreme amount of time every single day in order to look more muscular. And we don't know what the long-term impact of steroid abuse in your adolescence is because we don't have the data to show that yet. So, yeah, I totally agree.
And I think that's the biggest, you know, that's my concern at the moment is, I mean, I'm very concerned about it all in general, but particularly on the younger generation, because I think especially with social media now, you know, it's not like you are just comparing yourselves to, when I was younger, the only people that I would really compare myself to was the people in my community, mostly the girls at school. Yeah. But now you can compare yourself to the entire world, and you can compare yourself to people that are a lot older, people that have a lot more money, people that it's literally their job to look good online. And I think that's what's scary. You know, we've got these massive pressures to look a certain way, but also looking a certain way has been really normalized because you just see those images all the time. And so your perception, or, you know, your thoughts about what a normal body looks like, is no longer what is actually physically attainable, particularly for somebody that's 15 years old.
Yeah, I agree. I'm almost so glad that I am not a teenager in today's society. I think I'd be completely, completely overwhelmed. And again, the one thing I would say that makes me quite hopeful is when I go into schools and I talk about this stuff with young people, they are incredibly clued up, I would say. Like, you know, they know a lot about who's using filters, what, you know, how people are kind of doing advertising in their Instagram captions, and they know about who's using the right angles, that sort of thing. I don't think it gets away from the problems you're describing about the way they're comparing themselves, but it does give me some hope that they're not as digital dinosaurs as maybe we are, and they've grown up in the world of almost fake reels and like making life look perfect and polished. But I am very concerned about the long-term impact this is going to have on the next generation.
Yeah. Well, I very much appreciate you bringing a positive angle, because I feel like I've been a complete negative Nancy. So that is very nice to hear. And maybe, you know, I don't know that many people in the younger generation. I don't know if you. And most of them actually are kind of, I don't want to be on social media. I don't want to have that in my life. I don't want to be showing my whole life on a platform where people can see it. So maybe we'll have a full 180 in terms of social media use. And the younger generation will be like, actually, do you know what? I just want to be in the moment and enjoy myself, which I think would be a wonderful kind of flip to have. So thank you so much, Rachel, for chatting to me today. I feel like you have brought so much insight. I've just rabbited on about random nonsense.
It's been so great.
I really, really appreciate you coming on and speaking about your experience. Where can people go to find out more about you or to reach out to you?
So they can contact me at rachel-egan.com. I'll make sure it's in the show notes for you, Hannah.
Thank you so much. And yeah, really appreciate you coming on. So thank you for chatting with me. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode on the Full of Beans podcast. I really hope you did enjoy it. As a little reminder, this is not a replacement for therapeutic advice, so please do seek support if you are struggling and know that there will always be somebody there to listen. Many thanks once again to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital. Have a lovely week, and I will see you next week for another episode of the Full of Beans podcast.